Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 78, titled Roadmap for Bardo.
First of all, there's a much greater danger than we know, which is, as I like to say when I read the Book of the Dead, nobody gets out of here a dead. Right? You can get out of here alive, but not a dead. You die, and whatever causes and conditions you have accumulated in your life that your mind is causing, your speech has caused, your physical acts have caused, the consequences of those causes will go with you, and your consciousness continues and finds other embodiments. And as long as you're a helpless victim of your unconscious, because you haven't spent your life becoming conscious of your unconscious, you'll be drawn by impulses. Your next birth will be an impulse purchase. Like when you're walking down Fifth Avenue and you just have to have that thing in that window. And you just walking, you're flying like a ghost-like between dream being. You'll be flying down Fifth Avenue and you just have to have that mom or you have to have that dad. And then, bang, you get reborn in that. You could read about the process. I think they're very well, it's very reasonable, well-documented process. You know? Karma, how you get reborn. So if you're an impulse-driven person, you know, that mom and dad are cute, but boy, they live in a rat hole. I don't want to go there. I don't want to live in that apartment. I'd rather be in a better neighborhood. You have no control if you haven't developed some control of your deeper impulses in your life. I always tell about my favorite lama passed away. He's reborn, actually, but I don't know the new one due to some karma. But the old one was so clever, but he was so upset about Miss Piggy. He really was upset about Miss Piggy. Have you ever checked out Miss Piggy? But you see, we said, well, Miss Piggy's cute. What's the problem? He says, that's the problem. She's cute. We said, well, what do you mean? That's what he said. Well, not for you, it's not a problem. But some child will fall in love with Miss Piggy. And then if they have prematurely die in an accident or, you know, they get a brain tumor, something happens, they're going to head for the pigsty. And then they'll think, you know, then they will wake up, oink, 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 it's terrible. And we said, but Rinpoche, there's many Buddhist, like with Disney stories. In fact, the original Disney stories probably are the Buddha's former life stories, called the Jataka tales. And so people could romanticize and glamorize animal life forms before. Yes, he said, but that's something you read about in a book. You know, you have the tale about the monkey king or the deer king or the jackal or the lion or the frog and the fox and all this kind of thing. But you're not having it in imagery going right into your brain from a big color TV day and night, he says. It's not imprinting you in the same way. He had a counter-argument. But our kids were already grown up by then, and they'd already been past their Miss Piggy phase, so we were kind of calm about it. But then I had to worry about my grandchildren. But that's the kind of way it goes, you know, is you don't want to be impulse buying. Similarly, if you see some in that dream state of after death, dream-like bardo state or between state after death, you don't want to be victim of some irrational fear, some paralyzing terror when you just see some gorilla coming at you or something like that. You want to be prepared. In the Book of the Dead, it says if you see like a demon coming at you, just laugh, relax. You know, they can't hurt you. You're just like a dream body. It can't actually be hurt. Just go right into the mouth of it and you'll come out into a garden of roses type of thing. They give instructions like that. Don't shrink away and try to hide from it and have it chase you. Then that'll be really bad. Then you'll look for something that will seem like a protective place to you and it will be a bad embodiment. Some kind of imprisoning, trapping embodiment. Human body is not that well defended, just as a body, you know. It's soft skin, no claws, no fangs. Only on Hollywood they have vampire fangs, but nobody really has decent teeth. Humans. So when you're scared, you're not going to really be attracted to human life form if you get too scared. You want to be like a big, powerful dinosaur or something. And so realistic worldview is causation. To suddenly realize we are totally interconnected in a bunch of causation. And therefore, we have to, and that has a positive side. We can control our condition by, you know, we take an aspirin, you know, we learn something about medicine, we learn about food, we try not to eat the bad food, et cetera, et cetera. You know, that's all because of an awareness of causation. But then this kind of the causation that Buddha discovered is much, much more all-embracing. It's beginningless and endless. And therefore, it commits us to really trying to pay attention to reality, to try to ameliorate our situation, and even to try to ameliorate the situation of those we love, and to discover who we really do love and why and how to love. And it becomes like a whole life becomes a learning process, basically. All life, not just school. School in a slave society is just teaching you where to fit into the production line. That's all. You know, where liberal education used to be a little better, but really, not really, because what liberal meant was the boss's class. Liberal in the sense of you were a boss, you were going to be an executive, you were going to make decisions. So you got to read Dostoevsky and something and Plato to be able to think and make decisions. And to, you know, read balance sheets and, you know, some math and do this and that. But the liberal was for the bosses, right? Unfortunately. I used to give talks about liberal versus liberating education and how the liberating education could fit on top of the liberal. But liberal by itself was not enough. But even that is totally threatened in our slave country, you know. You got to be pre-med from the minute you step into college because you're paying a fortune of money, or your parents are, or you're going into debt to the banks, and you have to have a productive profession, and you can make money as a doctor. Never mind, you might not cure many people, but you can make money. So realistic worldview is to really see yourself as a nexus of causal processes, to slowly, gradually try to be critical of any sense of that there's anything isolated from the causal nexus within which you're swimming, the causal ocean within which you're swimming, and to be able to become a better swimmer. And of course, very, very key is the mind. Within that kind of a worldview, the causation of the mind becomes the king of causations or queen of causations. The science of the mind becomes the king and queen of the sciences. And especially because they discovered, the good news is, in that tradition, in that scientific tradition, they discovered that the best way of controlling the mind is with the mind, not with drugs. I mean, yes, drugs, like they're herbs, you know, there's psychedelic drugs, there's herbs, there's healing drugs, there's whatever, there's all kinds of, they had plenty of botany, those people. Actually, they had very sophisticated chemistry and botany. And you know, you can get crazed by bad consumption and so forth, definitely. But, you know, your machinery of your brain and your mind, it can be. But finally, the deeper level of the mind has to be controlled by the mind. And then we have this marvelous human thing, which is this human's intelligence. And we can read books, so we can share the intelligence of millions of people and people in the past. And other animals can't do that. They don't, you know, there's, you know, the horse doesn't read the book of, you know, Seacrest or whatever, the winner of the Kentucky Derby. You can't read a book about how to be a winner. They just have to run away and hope for the best. But we can study it, you know. My kids used to read all these chess books and then finally beat the crap out of that. I quit playing chess. Couldn't stand up to them anymore because they studied. So I would make a move and say, oh, yeah, so-and-so did that in New Orleans. Bing, bing, bing. Oh, they did? Then I would try to read, but I had no time because I had to publish in Paris, you know, to support them. So that's really great. So we have this marvelous intelligence. So it isn't a depressing thing, but it's a little scary. People are scared. You know, Carl Sagan, when he was old, he was a great person. I liked him very much. But when he was older, he wrote a book like When Demons Stalk the Earth. It actually had that title. And of course, he was freaked out by the people in Arkansas, the fundamentalists, creationists, because he didn't want to be Giordano. Probably in his previous life, he was Giordano Bruno, and he was burned at the stake in Bologna, you know, for doing some science. So he was really scared of them. And so they're really scared. The modern science people are really scared of the church. And so they're really scared of having a soul or a mind. And they're really scared of future life. And therefore, and they associate that with some total non-rational thing, and therefore they will not investigate the evidence of memory of previous lives that many people have documented, that they themselves can, you can easily discover your own memories of previous lives. It's not that difficult. You can, I don't know about Brian Weiss, he's usually in two big crowds now, so I don't know if it really works, but there are regression therapists who can help you do that one-on-one. Very definitely, people have success in that. And then they can question whether that's really future or former life, or whether, you know, they're doing all, it's inscribed in your gene. You know, your parent had a similar experience inscribed in your gene, so you're getting it from your parent. They want to just get back to, you're a material product of your parents. That's what they want to get it back to. And your species. They're so scared of having a subjectivity that will go on. And so they violate their law of thermodynamics. Now, the Buddhists make it easy for them. The Buddhist philosophers, because they have a dualist theory. Buddhism has many scientific theories. Like I said, it has many teachings and many theories. And they have a dualistic theory about body and mind, where they teach that the mind is non-material. And I've seen these dialogues where they're all being polite to the Dalai Lama, these scientists, and they're saying, okay, Your Holiness, we'll have to think about how a non-material thing can influence matter. We'll have to think about that. Or really, what they're too polite to say, how a non-material thing can matter. We'll think about it. But of course, they won't. They absolutely will not. And the Buddhists insist on that because in ancient time, the way the scientists were in India and other places, they were worried about nihilists, meaning, or materialists, which are now the orthodoxy here, you know, is materialism. And there were a few of them who were considered very dangerous in ancient India or China. When someone who has no responsibility to a future life of themselves, much less to other people, is in charge of a society, their decisions will be incredibly short-term and self-seeking. And they'll be very harmful to the society, to others, to the environment, to animals, to everything. They considered, which correctly considered. And so they always wanted to say, well, there's something that isn't material that you're going to have to deal with to them. They would say that. But today, it's not necessary to say that. And then in the most subtle level of Buddhist, like in the Book of the Dead, which comes from the most subtle Buddhist scientists, which are those who study the Tantra, which is the whole thing about, and the Tantra has nothing to do with partying and orgying and violence and weird ritual temple of doom sort of thing. It's nothing to do with that. It does have to do with Eros and Thanatos in the mind. It is the ultimate way of exploring the unconscious and really gaining mastery of it and control of it and finding out where you can't control, but at least channeling that in such a way. So it won't be harmful. At the deepest, most subtle level, there is no difference between mind and body because mind is always enveloped in a kind of energy. You know, it has a subtle energy. And it's super subtle, though. So I tried to tell those people in that dialogue, look, guys, it's not a matter of non-material to material. It's a matter of super subtle to coarse. And that should be good for you because you guys are dealing, you've lost control of things at the super subtle level with your quantum thing, even though you're desperately trying to pretend that you're going to regain it as soon as you catch the dark matter, you catch the Higgs boson by quadruple inference. They never caught no Higgs boson. Something shatters and then there's like an inference from some effects that fits with a theory. Nobody grabbed the hold of no Higgs boson. Bozo, I call it the Higgs bozo. But actually, I shouldn't, because boson, you know where it comes from? It comes from an Indian physicist named Bose. Calcutta, Bengali guy. That's where boson comes from. He discovered the boson, theoretically. You know, because Indians are great mathematicians. They're great scientists, actually. So this is the thing about both Theravada and Mahayana, any kind of Buddhism, is this realistic worldview and getting realistic about your embeddedness in causation. And once you get embedded in causation, you adopt the law of thermodynamics, which is that no energy can be created out of nothing, and no energy can ever become nothing. It can be diffuse in a big, I don't think crunch is the right word, I think slush is more like the right word, a big smoosh. And then there's a big regathering, I think, really, rather than crunch. The crunch thing they do because they think it's all crunched down to a black hole, because they ultimately want to have it come out of nothing. That's their big dream, is to have it all come out of nothing. Then they can have a first beginning where there was nothing before, and then it comes out of nothing. And then they're back in church and they're happy. And actually, the big slush and, you know, entropy they talk about, you know, that's more like it. Big kind of diffusion, over relaxation, and then a regathering again is more like it. But it's beginningless and endless, and therefore you are beginningless and endless. You've been everywhere, done everything, and you don't necessarily want to do it all again in the same way. So then, given infinite future, there's no telling what you couldn't make out of yourself and what you couldn't make out of your world, given infinite time. You know? They have like things like generations of birds flying on a certain, making a nest on a certain ledge where the wing brushes the rock. It has cleft the rock over 1,000 years, type of idea, you know? Right? Rocks are all ground by oceans into sand, you know, fine sand, you know, big, huge boulders. Time is very powerful. And then you have infinite time. You cannot say that you cannot become anything. You can be anything given that time. If you understand the causation of how to constantly improve and evolve in a positive direction, then you can be infinitely positive. And then, in theory, what is infinitely positive? If you were a life form that was made of bliss, self-aware, blissful, with access to abundant or even infinite energy, loving of all beings, meaning using that infinite energy, why not, to share the bliss, wishing every being to be happy and effectively being able to do so, who wouldn't want to be like that? And even if, you know, and then not like by the end of the weekend or forget about it, but gradually over maybe 100 million lifetimes, who cares? Well, you know, when you get there, it's the next minute. And then there's all kind of ways, and there's whole science, a huge, huge scientific tradition from non-slave societies, from non-slave cultures, higher cultures than ours, less violent than ours, actually, that were conquered by our Euro-American culture as a sign of their superiority, actually, rather than inferiority. White man's burden? I don't think so. White man as a burden, with his British stiff upper lip and his gun and his whatever, his insatiable appetite for spices and whatever. Spices and sexes and domineering and whatever, you know, still stiff upper lip. I love that guy in the Gandhi movie. There's that great guy who plays a British officer. Well, Mr. Gandhi, you really don't think we're just going to leave all of this here and just walk on out of here, do you? Mm-hmm. Gandhi looks up with his little, like, wearing his little underwear there, you know, his little dhoti. He says, yeah, walking will get you to Bombay and the ship. You can walk. You can take a train, but you can also walk. Guy was so shocked. I'm sorry. I know it's irrelevant. Okay, but it's a counter of cultures, you know. So think about causation, okay? We'll come back to it again tonight. It's time for dinner.